Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. I remind you on the way to this conversation that support for WEAA is provided by Bosch, offering Bosch dishwashers at your local Bosch retailer. And this is Mark Steiner. We're going to focus the next 2 hours on Trayvon Martin and, of course, George Zimmerman. We keep saying Trayvon Martin, but it's George Zimmerman who was freed. And before we get there, we're going to go through quickly our day in history today, on this July 15th, Monday, July 15th. Some of them do make me pause for reflection on some of the things, a few things I'll read today. In 1482, Muhammad XII is crowned the 22nd and last Nasrid king of Granada. That's an important day because it was the last moment in that part of southern Spain where a society of equity existed, where Muslims, Christians, Jews, Africans, Arabs, Europeans actually lived in a place where they all had equality at more levels than none, which was destroyed after they were taken over in 1492 by the Spaniards and the Catholic Church, who drove them all out. I just think that's a moment for reflection. This is also the day that General A.J. Smith and 14,000 men, including the 1st Brigade of the United States Colored Troops in 1864, in the Battle of Tupelo, where hundreds and hundreds of black men died on the battlefield for freedom of America and their freedom, defeated Nathan B. Forrest at that place in Tupelo, Mississippi, the man who later created the Ku Klux Klan. This is also the day when, in 1870, the Reconstruction era in the United States, Georgia became the last of the former Confederate states to be readmitted to the Union. And it was a period in some ways for us to reflect, are we going through another period where forces of reaction are taking back, quote-unquote, the America that they think belongs to them? This, in many ways, what's happening today in our country makes me think of what happened during Reconstruction and where we are today in a different kind of era in the 21st century. This was also the day that that Jimmy Carter made that famous speech. He said, "This crisis is in the growing doubt about the meaning of our own lives and the loss of unity of our purpose for our nation, his great malaise speech. And this country is in a malaise, I think, in many ways. It's time maybe to reflect on what that might mean for in a larger sense. So we'll leave that for today in history and turn to where we are today. And I heard, of course, 11 o'clock at night, or 10 o'clock at night, as many people heard, that the jury came back Saturday night to say that George Zimmerman was acquitted on all charges. Stephanie Marfromas, one of my producers, texted me immediately saying this was happening. We got to work thinking about what to do today. This is a day I was going to be off during this week, but there's no way to take off on a day like today. We all had to be here together to kind of reflect on what this means. And I was really hit and struck very deeply by some of the intensity of the discussions taking place on my Facebook page. I'll be reading some of that during the course of these next hour, 2 hours, because it was the pain in some people's minds and hearts, but also you could see how far apart we are. And I'll read some of that, how people just don't see this and say at all, especially in the white world and what all that means. And I'll be reading some reflections of other people who contacted me over the weekend. We are joined here in studio by Hadar Ayira. Hadar Ayira is a project manager of the More in the Middle initiative at Associated Black Charities, facilitator and analyst at Baltimore Racial Justice Action, and spoken word artist. Good to have you back, Hadar.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Dr. Kimberly Moffitt is with us, assistant professor of American Studies at UMBC and author of Blackberries and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair and Body Politics in African Communities. Kimberly, great to have you back.
Thank you.
Doug Colbert, professor of law at the University of Maryland, Carey School of Law. Doug, good to have you in the studio as well.
Nice to be here, Mark.
And joining us by phone is Edward Wyckoff Williams, author, columnist, contributing editor of The Root, who has been in touch with Trayvon's family a lot during this and has written a great deal on The Root and more. And Edward, good to have you back with us.
A pleasure to be with you, Mark.
Let me just read this and we'll jump right into our thoughts here, reflections. This is written by a man who is a poet and who is somebody who also runs one of the major literary centers at Howard University, and a dear, dear friend, Ethelbert Miller. And Ethelbert wrote, "How many of us are crossing our T's today? Much discussion about Trayvon, but what about Troy? Do we still remember Troy Davis, executed on September 21st, 2011? This is important. Will we remember Trayvon 2 years from now? So many black boys and men die strange, unnatural deaths. Don't be fooled by telling black boys not to wear hoodies. It's the skin, dummy. Our blackness is what others would want to make us suffer for. But is blackness a curse? Of course not. We need to stop viewing ourselves as victims. One case of what we might consider injustice is not an indictment of a country or a legal system. We make a big mistake as a society when we look at polls and our courts to determine justice. We cannot compromise our legal system because someone looks guilty. We all have a right to our opinions. We can't sip only the facts we want to drink. The thirst for justice is a lifetime thing. Today, our lips happen to be dry. So, Edward, let me start with you since you're on the phone. Thanks for joining us once again. I know you have a ton of national programs to do, so I appreciate you jumping on our show today here, first thing in the morning.
It's always a pleasure to be with you. I was, I'm not quite sure what the guy was saying there. I'm going to have to twirl that around in my head for a little bit, but I just want to start out by saying I spoke to Benjamin Crump, the Martin family attorney, last night, and Natalie Jackson, who is the family's local counsel in Florida. And there is good news that he has been in direct touch with people at Eric Holder's Justice Department, and they are aggressively seeking to pursue the case. They just need to make sure that they actually have the evidence. What's interesting is that that might happen in conjunction with a civil proceeding being brought by Sabrina Fulton. Benjamin Crump told me that Sabrina left church yesterday and called him and said, "I will not let this verdict define my son. She said, "We will be the agent of Trayvon's legacy." And so she wanted him to begin making a plan for civil proceedings against George Zimmerman. I think that to that end, I guess the quote that you read, this idea that justice is a process and that it continues, is basically true. And I think that we are very heavy about this decision. I was completely demoralized. I had two articles to write, and I couldn't do anything for about 24 hours. And I'm feeling very positive now in a way that I didn't expect to, because after speaking to Benjamin Crump, I realized that there is a march for justice that continues, and this process is a complicated one. But like the quote from Martin Luther King, the arc of justice, the arc of the moral universe bends toward justice, and I think that we will eventually get resolution here. But the fact that this is so close and so correlated to the Emmett Till decision really breaks my heart that in these 60 years, not much has changed, particularly in the American South.
I'll just reflect a minute, just what we all are looking at this, and go to Doug and then to Adar and Dr. Kimberly Moffitt.
Well, it's a very sad day, Mark, and listeners, for the American legal system, for the justice system. We've seen too many acquittals of people who have killed African-American people throughout the history of this country. And these are very difficult cases for prosecutors to successfully prosecute because they typically see Trayvon Martin as the defendant, not as the person that they're trying to vindicate and protect the life. And the crime against Trayvon Martin is a crime not only against him and his family and his loved ones, but the entire African-American community, the community of people who have children of color, the people who really want a fair justice system. And in order to prosecute these crimes, number one, you must have a multiracial jury that includes significant representation of African-American jurors. This outcome was predictable the moment that this jury was selected. And I say that based upon history, based upon the research that shows over and over again that predominantly white or all white juries have been unable to convict the killers of African Americans throughout this nation's history. The social science shows that you must have had two African American jurors in order for the deliberation to have meaning to the predominantly white jury. It's not that I'm saying that all white people are prejudiced, are racist, are bad people. The conversation is a very different one once you're able to bring the perspective that Trayvon Martin faced that evening. In addition to the jury, you had to have a prosecution that was able to prosecute George Zimmerman, people who represent the law enforcement side, people who generally are on the side of the prosecution. And this prosecution was almost a halfway effort to prosecute. Witnesses were unprepared when they testified. The prosecutor did not go with the theory that I think makes the most sense, which is George Zimmerman was lying, and his lies were profound and they were repetitive. And once you are able to take away Zimmerman's self-defense, then the pieces of the prosecution can fit together. But it's only true if you've got people on the jury who are listening and willing to accept. And then you had to have a judge who understood, as the prosecutor should have understood, that race was critical to this entire case.
And I'm going to come back to these points, because those 2 points about the prosecution and the multiracial jury are critical to the legal aspect of this. Adar.
I agree with you, and I was not surprised. I was dismayed, but I was not surprised. The issue is larger than just Trayvon Martin. The issue is one of the cultural stigmatization of blackness, and that in any and every circumstance, you are guilty until you are proven innocent. You are guilty by virtue of the blackness of your skin. And increasingly now, along with the blackness of your skin, if you are young and if you are male, then you are guilty. And it would not have mattered whether Trayvon Martin was wearing a hoodie or any other thing. It is the cultural stigmatization, the American cultural stigmatization of blackness and the anti-blackness of this society that is the problem here.
Kelly Moffitt.
I can only echo that sentiment. You know, even in our text, we talk about how the black body is revered and reviled simultaneously. And this is even more poignant when you think about the black male body as being that space where we place upon it something that we love. I mean, when we think about sports, immediately we think about black men and their ability, their athletic ability to perform at sports. And we love that part of that body. But that's the same body, even in the midst of playing a sport, that we also criminalize, that we villainize in many ways. And we haven't been able to remove the reviling part of that black body to accept people as human beings solely and as individuals, but instead we continue to place upon or script on that body that it represents all the things, the negative things, the violence, the criminal behavior that exists in one space and in one, on one body. It doesn't exist anywhere else in America except for that one particular body. And I think that's probably the biggest part of understanding what we're doing to the Trayvon Martins of the world. I also think when I think about the response that we're seeing, which seems to be largely along racial lines in terms of how we are reacting to the verdict, I think about there's a scholar, Darnell Martin, who talks about this idea of raced ways of seeing, where he argues that we can't even see our world, especially in America, without seeing it through the lens of our racial or ethnic background. And that has a lot to do with the history of America, of course, and its foundation. So by virtue of that, it's not so unfamiliar to see that a jury such as this could not see what many of us on the other side were seeing in terms of this being a racial issue. All they could see is that this was a mistake that happened, but this person should not be held responsible when, in fact, there was something very racial about
it. So, go ahead, Adar.
I agree with you, and part of that is because in this society, whites are taught to see themselves as being deracialized. So if there's any talk about race at all, it is always coming from the people who are racially othered in society, which again reinforces the notion that they and them are the problem and that they inject race, quote unquote, in any and every conversation.
Well, let me go to the phones here, and I'll come back and bring Edward right back in because he only has another 10 minutes or so with us at 410-319-8888. And he can reflect with us on this, and some people are going to look at this and go, well, it's down on your show today, it's a bit one-sided, but that's because we want to reflect on this in a certain way today, and we'll be coming to this in different angles. And I think that one of the things about race in this case I want to explore with you all is that what we just said here. And I'll just say, on the other hand, even though I've had a lot of comments on my Facebook page that reflect everything that both Adar and Kimberly just spoke to, and very vehemently, and I'll read some of those. On the other hand, when you look at the hundreds, the thousands and thousands of people who went out into the streets in New York City, in Oakland, here in Baltimore, in Miami, across America, Los Angeles, these were demonstrations primarily of young people that were absolutely diverse. They were multiracial demonstrations. You see the hands in the air in these demonstrations, like the picture of New York City I just looked at before we went on the air. The hands were as white as they were black as they were brown. There is a slow shift that I think. Go ahead, Ever. I hear you nodding. Mm-hmm. What are you about to say, Edward?
Yes, I am nodding, and I think that this is a generational divide. I think that so many young white kids, Latino kids, Asian kids see Trayvon as their friend, and that is the future of America. That is the promise of the post-racial age. The problem here is that our criminal justice system has not caught up to where the country is moving toward. And we have, as the women were explaining, we have built into this system an implicit racism that stigmatizes young black males as criminal. And we have the remnants of the war on drugs. And we have programs like Stop and Frisk that have legislated and standardized this kind of treatment of young black males and the criminalization of their bodies and degradation of their bodies. Anytime you are walking down the streets in New York and young black males can be stopped, frisked, fondled, treated with disrespect, beaten even by police with no regard for any sort of civil rights. And that's in New York City. So in the backwoods of Florida, why would you not expect this result, right? And that's what's so sad about this is, yes, the future is bright, and young people are intermarrying and mixing at schools and everything. Like this promise of what Barack Obama literally embodies is actually happening, but it's happening on the ground. It's not happening at the upper echelons where white males still dominate and hold power. And so when you look at that courtroom, you had two white male defense attorneys, you had two white male prosecutors, you had five white women on a six-woman jury, and you had a white woman presiding over it all as judge. There is no way that any of those people really could have the proper perspective in order to understand that this was just a boy walking home, because for them, that boy is not a boy. He's not a child. He's a black male, and that is the prism through which they see him, and that prism is defined by the way we have stigmatized black males in this society.
So now, both Doug wants to say something. I saw Dar, you disagreed a moment with what he was saying. Did you?
Well, there's a little bit of of a framing that I can offer here. And one is that I do think what he's saying is correct in terms of interpersonal relationships and the way that especially with the Gen X and millennials, there are more interracial relationships. However, when we come to the understanding and the framing and the maintenance of structural racism and institutional racism and the ways in which those power dynamics work, when you look at studies that are done about the attitudes of those same younger generations of whites, there is a correlation with the attitudes of their elders.
But I've seen
when it comes to privilege. And that doesn't discount what he's saying, but it is making the distinction between our personal and interpersonal relationships and then the institutional and the structural powers and the way in which whiteness is maintained in society.
I completely agree with you.
I know for me, Mark, and we talked about this before the show began, that I felt like for the millennials that we're talking about, this was their smack in the face that, oh, racism is still here. because we have, I mean, I sit in, I teach classes year after year where students keep saying to me, Dr. Moffitt, you're the one that is putting race out there. We don't deal with this issue mm-hmm. anymore because we are living the colorblind dream of our society. But the reality is when we talk about what's happening in our institutions or what has happened in our institutions and continues is that there is a structural system that race does play a role and it keeps continuing and being carried out. And the reality is that even those students who believe they are functioning in this colorblind society, especially if they are white, are still being able to benefit from that structure that's in place. Yeah. And so that is what I think, which is why I think it is interesting that the demonstrations were racially diverse. But I do think that there's a part where the students or the young people have been naive to believe that these are things of the past that we're not dealing with anymore. And this was the smack in the face.
Well, I think that's right. But I'll say this. I have a little bit of pushback on that. I agree. And there's some points I think are much more progressive going on among young folks than we're giving credit for here.
But let's talk about the institution of justice, of the criminal justice system, because that's where this all took place. And I think everything that people are talking about makes absolute sense. I, too, am optimistic about this current generation of young people because they do see things differently. Whether they'll maintain that belief is a separate issue. But in the justice system, there is a bleaching out of race. When you have jury selection, there's this myth that any six people that you choose for a jury can be fair and impartial to the side that's representing the loss of an African American person. So that in this particular jury, you know, people would say, the prosecutors, the judge would say, well, these are very good people. These are nice people. These people try very hard. But there is a piece of the justice system that requires this multiracial participation. And the history of our country is that black jurors have been excluded from serving on juries. They were not deemed qualified to render justice in cases. So when you come up with a situation where you want to be sure that a verdict is based on evidence and not on race, you must have significant participation of black jurors. When you look at our – I'm sorry, go ahead.
I didn't mean to – I was only leaping in because we only have a couple minutes left in the segment. I know Edward has to run off. I want to give Edward a chance to finish up his thoughts before we have to take a break and he has to go to his next interview. Edward?
One of the things that – one of the points that I wanted to make back to what one of the panelists was saying about structural racism is – and this is disheartening – is that – we see this stigmatization of black males exist even at the highest levels. And I think that, yes, I am extremely optimistic about the millennial generation. And I do believe, like you do, Mark, that we are probably not giving them as much credit as they deserve. But when you look at the presidency of Barack Obama and what he has faced in the last, 5 years now, in terms of bucking against the white male-dominated Republican Party that seeks to invalidate his presidency by deconstructing any legislative victories he has, blocking him from making judicial appointments, which would literally be his presidential legacy. When you see that, I feel like that invalidation that they hope to achieve and that they might very well be able to achieve if they hold on to the House after 2014 is the same invalidation of Trayvon Martin's civil rights. It's this idea that no black man has any rights, which a white man must respect, even if that man is president of the United States. And I think that there's something really dark here. There's something that's still going on in this country at the underbelly. And we must deconstruct that and tease that out. And it's thank God for people like you and everyone that's on this panel and everyone that's engaged as listeners who are having this conversation and all those young people who were out protesting. I'm here in New York right now, and they were marching up to 125th Street here in Harlem. It's wonderful to see that. It's wonderful to have that the people engaged in the process. But until we work out the structural issues, particularly in criminal justice, things like this will remain.
Edward Wyckoff Williams, always great to have you with us. Thank you so much, my friend.
Thank you, buddy.
We have to take a brief break and come back with the three guests here with us in studio, Adair Ayira, Kimberly Moffitt, and Doug Colbert, and you at 410-319-8888. We will go to the phones. We're going to explore in the coming hour issues around the trial itself and how it was prosecuted that Doug and I have been talking about over the weekend that Charles Blow wrote about in the New York Times. We're going to be looking at some issues that Luis Rodriguez brought up about how we have to fight for system change in this country and what that means. And we're going to be talking to folks in Florida about the demonstrations coming up there as well. Stay with us for all that coming up. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We are still here with our guest, Adair Ayira, who is project manager of the More in the Middle initiative at Associated Black Charities, facilitator and analyst at Baltimore's Racial Justice Action, spoken word artist, and becoming a frequent guest on the show, which is a good thing. Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, assistant professor of American Studies at UMBC, author of Blackberries and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body Politics in Africana Communities, and Doug Colbert, professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, Carey School of Law. We're also now joined by Lenny McAllister, conservative media personality, public speaker, and writer. Lenny, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me again, Mark.
And we're going to jump right to the phones here. I'm going to read this one piece, and we'll read Luis Rodriguez's piece at the top of the hour. This is a piece by a 16-year-old in Marietta, Georgia, and it was my daughter, my youngest of our clan. And this is what I was thinking about the millennials and what she wrote in, just to reflect on some of the young people are thinking. Seriously, not guilty? And people don't understand why I don't like this country. Our justice system is so messed up. An unarmed teenager is shot and killed, and we spend his trial questioning whether or not he had pot in his system and listening to 911 calls over and over. A mother doesn't get to see her son for the rest of her life. And the man who killed her is walking away scar-free. I don't care if it was unintentional or intentional, if it was manslaughter or second-degree murder. Seriously, this man killed someone walking on the sidewalk because he looked suspicious. After clear instructions to stay in his car, I don't know why it wasn't reason enough to see it wasn't self-defense. Someone needs to start working on reforming something in the system. And her reflections with all people in her generation were raising issues of race and class. And I do see, in many ways, I think some of us who are older don't see the shift. And we get stuck in places where we don't see the shift taking place.
Okay, let me just say this. I'm not stuck in place. I want to be.
I want to
be. No, but I'm just. I'm claiming it. I want to be very clear about that. Just like the hippies of the '60s, who were protesting against the war, protesting against racism, now are in positions where they continue doing things the way things have been done, and in essence continue structural and institutional racism. So will some of the millennials of today, because if you get into positions of power and you do not know about structural and institutional racism, you don't recognize it, you don't know how it manifests, you don't know how it's implemented, you are comfortable with your privilege, and as Dr. Kimberly was saying, you look through your specific lens, and that's the only lens, then this country will continue doing business as usual and nothing will change. You can have as all the variety of interpersonal, interracial relationships that you want, but if you're not dealing with the issue of institutional and structural racism, that does not matter, because it's not the interpersonal that truncates the life's chances,
right,
and life's choices of people of color.
No, I don't see it all. I'm not talking about the interpersonal. I think the interpersonal is in some ways, it's important, but it's the least important. And I would actually push back a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the hippies of the '60s. People who were radicals and political activists who fought in the '60s, in their '60s and '70s, are still fighting. Then that's not the same thing. It's a very different perspective. And I think people who just kind of willingly like to play with it is one thing. People who are dedicated to it is a very different thing.
I agree with that, but there are a lot of those people now who are in positions of power. We all wear different identities, and we shift identities as we grow. There are some of us who continue to stay in it, and there are some of us who do not. And if they don't bring that lens that they had in those different identities when they were fighting for it, and if they just meld into the power structure without questioning, without changing it, then Mark, what does it matter what they did when they were younger?
And I
was pushed back saying a lot of people do, and I think it's not just the people, it's the system itself. It's what has been inculcated in this nation from its roots that has created this system that allows anybody who's in a position of power, be they white, black, Mexican, Puerto Rican, to push the same racist buttons as anybody else does.
That's absolutely true. But here's the difference. The difference is if I'm sitting in a position of power and I push the button, I'm just denigrating myself and my own chances and choices as well as those of everybody in my community. If you do it, you are benefiting yourself and your family and everybody in your community. It doesn't make it right. We both maintain it. But the outcomes of that and the implications and the impact is different, and we have to own that.
The impact is different, though. I think this is the show we need to do another day.
Okay.
Lenny, let me get your take and then go to the phones. Lenny, I'm sorry. You're on the air. We should have got you written right away. Lenny, you there? Do we have our guest? Lenny?
I'm here.
Yeah.
Yes. I thought you said Glenn. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I thought we were going to the phone.
Go ahead.
I think that one of the things that we have to understand is that, you know, there's been one race of people throughout the history of the United States of America that has a negative, criminalizing, dehumanizing image affiliated with it. And if anybody thinks that we've moved past racism that much and that we're post-racial because we've had an African-American president and black governors and everything else, the last witness was a white woman with her children being terrorized by those black thugs. And that was the image. We weren't allowed to talk about racial profiling, but the very thing that happened with the last witness that the defense brought up was racial profiling.
Right.
The very last image that the defense brought up was an image of Trayvon Martin with his shirt off, mm-hmm. trying to show definition in his chest at 155 pounds, which all 155-pound teenage boys.
We all did it. We all did it.
they show that. Why? To show the menacing black thug. That is 1955, and you know, I sent out a tweet over Saturday night. I said, listen, the bottom line is what was said was, you know, you can kill an unarmed teenager if they're walking down the street with a hoodie on or if they're whistling at your wife. I mean, there's nothing that much different between what happened to Emmett Till, who was brutalized over doing something silly that a 14-year-old may or may not have done, versus what happened to Trayvon Martin, who was just a few weeks after his 17th birthday walking home to go watch the NBA All-Star game and put a hoodie on his head because it started raining. And if you look at what we're dealing with in America, when the disparities between blacks and whites is growing, so you have growing racial disparities, growing racial divisiveness as far as the tone, and you're seeing an increase in racial profiling from stop and frisk in New York City to, you know, we just had the John Brown job situation here a couple of years ago where there was a police chief that was torturing black men into confessions by, and some of the methodologies included putting testicles on these black, putting electrodes on these black men's testicles. So if you look at where we're going over the last 20 years, Johnny Gamage in my native Pittsburgh and Abdu Diallo in New York City mm-hmm. and Sean Bell, we're not going in the right direction. So anybody that says that, you know, we just need to take a step back, this is just about one man and one teenage boy. No, this isn't even about one man and one teenage boy. This is a trend. When T.J. Holmes, when Tyler Perry can be pulled over driving while black in Atlanta, of all places, we're not talking about Ames, Iowa. We're talking about Atlanta, Georgia, where there are plenty of black millionaires down there. When they're pulled over driving while black, and these are celebrities, we're going in the wrong direction. And I do think it's going to have to take a social revolution to come about, a peaceful social revolution, but it's time to have a social revolution so that we can start changing the civics, we can start changing the policy, and we can start leveling this playing field once and for all.
Let me open the phones here. People are dying to get in this conversation. So, and we'll go Doug, who hasn't spoken in a few minutes. We'll come back to him at 410-319-8888. Bruce, you're on the air.
Yeah, I appreciate you letting me on the phone. So, you know, I'm going to say from completely different perspective. So I would appreciate if you'd at least be fair and let me try to make my statement. I try to keep it brief, but I wish I had an hour because...
You don't have an hour because we have a lot of people behind.
Well, no, I understand
that. Don't start yelling, Bruce.
Okay, well, wait a minute.
Bruce, stop.
Wait a minute, stop interrupting me.
All right.
So you know what this
is? Pull Bruce down. Listen to me, Bruce. You're allowed to say what you say. If you start yelling at the phone, I'm hanging up on you. So come back up. Finish what you have to say.
Anybody's professional social scientist would see how ridiculous this nonsense is. That's what it's all about. You've injected race into this. You know, Mr. Zimmerman had his head pounded into the concrete. Was Trayvon Martin really that innocent? It's a shame he was killed. But let's look at it realistically, objectively, instead of all this emotional cycle babble.
Bruce, stop. You're yelling into the phone.
No, you don't.
So, Bruce, if I may, Mark, I mean, number one, George Zimmerman was at the brink of death, getting his head pounded into the ground, but he went to work the next day. He went to continue his MMA classes that same week. He went to school on Tuesday. So he was at the brink of death, but he was able to resume his normal lifestyle literally 12 hours later. That's number one. Number two, injecting race comes about as soon as you say somebody looks suspicious just because they're walking with a hoodie on in the wintertime when it starts to rain, just because they look a particular way. That is profiling, whether people want to admit that or not. And I know there's a lot of crazy, and I'm going to call them crazy, there's a lot of crazy conservatives out there that want to justify their inherent racism and hate of President Obama, etc., in this case. And I stand with a group called Black Conservatives for Trayvon. We understand what was going on in his case. And this is the problem that the Republican Party and the conservative movement has. They don't want to admit that we are dealing with two different Americas. I'm called a race baiter for talking about the disparities that we face in Black America. But then we hear this type of ridiculous rhetoric that comes about with this underlying tone of racism when it comes to dealing with Black youth and how this gorilla, I mean, look at how they anamorphized Rachel Gentile. They made her out to be an ape on Twitter and tweeted that around. That was a very viral picture when she stood at the witness stand. But we don't have racism going on anymore in America. We've already seen the First Lady as an ape. We've seen other people as an ape. We've had watermelons on the front lawn of the White House. But racism is not injected into most things that we're doing in America nowadays. It's ridiculous. And people like Bruce need to step back and allow us to fix the problems so that we can have a restrengthened America.
And for a minute, before we go back to the phones, I do want to get to there's a lot of callers here. I want to get them before we go to break. I want you to just come back to the justice piece, because one of the things about the Zimmerman thing, just that people argue about being beaten in the head, clearly it was shown that didn't happen. It did not happen.
Well, the way the story is told by Mr. Zimmerman is that his head was hit against the cement 20 to 25 times over and over again. And that defies logic. It's so incredulous. It's the kind of a statement that if your head was hit against a cement just two or three or four times, you would expect serious injury. And that's what the medical testimony was. But that testimony's not emphasized by the prosecution. Or if there was this bleeding, and if Trayvon Martin was on top, you would expect DNA. You would expect, you know, blood samples, you would have evidence to support. Instead, you have Mr. Zimmerman first saying, according to the police, that his encounter with Trayvon Martin was when Trayvon was supposed to jump out of the bushes and confront him. Well, there were no bushes. There was nothing resembling bushes. It didn't happen that way. So the next day, Mr. Zimmerman changes his story and comes up with something else. If you look through this evidence, and you do it with an open mind, you're going to find so many inconsistencies that they can only be called a package of lies. And usually when a defendant is lying and is inconsistent, that's something that the prosecution will seize upon to tell a jury, you can forget about this self-defense claim. It didn't exist. There are too many ways in which the defendant Zimmerman changed his story over and over again. The police just said slight discrepancy. I've been involved on the defense side my whole life. I've never heard police say slight discrepancy when somebody tells a completely different story several times.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark.
Hi,
can
Dave.
You hear me?
Yes, we can.
very refreshing show. As an activist looking to what we can do, of course, we know the struggle begins anew every day. 5 o'clock demonstration at the Inner Harbor in Maryland today. Gun laws in Maryland. The group Marylanders Against Gun Violence is a good one. We need to work here. Also, I'm thinking, how about boycotting Florida products or sort of following the money and hitting them where it hurts?
What are your thoughts about where activists go from here? If you want to jump in on this, Adara?
I think that we really have to, number one, become more aware of, again, how structural and institutional racism operates. And I, you know, a lot of times what we do is really transactional. We want to fix something very specific that is in front of us. And so we do that, we feel good about ourselves, and then we go away until the next specific issue occurs. This is an ongoing issue. There are stand your ground laws in, I think it's over 29 states. Structural and institutional racism operates every day. And so here Trayvon Martin was killed by this, he was murdered. And just coincidentally, because I just keep thinking this, the defense's case that he was armed with concrete, you know, because he pounded. If that's the case, then we're all armed and dangerous every
all
single
the time.
Day, right? Every single day. But we need to start focusing on system change, because it is the building of prisons. It is the lack of investment in communities of color. It is taking away every single thing, recreation activities, arts activities. Heck, in some of our schools, even you know, algebra is not taught, and that is the core curriculum for getting into college. So we're talking about an issue that is specific to Trayvon Martin and to young black males across America, but we're also talking about a larger issue that puts every single black and brown person in this country at risk, and that is what I'm suggesting that activists concentrate on.
Go ahead.
I also think, you know, the activism has to take place in the day-to-day operation of our criminal justice system. So day after day we see, you know, predominantly black defendants remaining in jail on minor charges, losing their freedom for 30, 40, 45 days because they don't have a lawyer, they don't have bail money. We seem to accept that. That seems to be okay as long as at the end the charge gets dismissed. But that changes people tremendously. The jail experience does. It seems okay when a judge sets a bail that the judge knows the person can't afford, or when a lawyer is not arguing vigorously for someone. Those are the smaller things that happen every day, and yet our courts are not filled with people from the community saying, no, that's not what we want to see happen with our tax dollars. We don't want them spent on more jails, on keeping people in jail when they need not be there. And that's the insensitivity. So when you talk about activism, Mark, the difficulty that some of us have encountered is that there's very few people who are challenging the system, who are fighting for the rights of people.
Part of that's,
well,
because
that's because people don't want to lose anything. And I've said this
right. Previously,
and I'll say it again.
That's
I think
right. That
black African Americans and Generation X are the most selfish generation of African Americans in the history of the United States. And it's about time for Generation X to not be afraid to lose their car, to lose their house, to possibly get a demotion at work for speaking out. I mean, we had people 50 years ago that got lynched, castrated, and killed fighting for the rights that we have right now, but we don't want to speak out on an ongoing basis. The civil rights movement wasn't a summer trend. It was a decades-long movement 50 years ago, and I think that it's time for Generation X, my generation, and people like us on the phone to take that type of passion ongoing, a long-burning fire, to really bring about positive permanent change.
So go ahead, Adora, quickly.
Very quickly. I would say this. I would expand that. It's not just about Generation X or Generation X's or millennials of color. White people benefit from institutional and structural racism, and they should be on the front lines as people with privilege and as people who are privileged by this system in working with people of color and in working on their own to dismantle it.
I'm going to read what Luis Rodriguez wrote, who'll be coming on the show soon. But let me also read this thing, then we'll go right to the phones here. Rhonda, your next caller up, we're going to come to your call here. Lieutenant Governor just wrote in, and I just want to read what the Lieutenant Governor just wrote in. He's now at the NAACP convention. And I was saying earlier to the folks here, the NAACP at this moment should be getting out of its meetings and actually walking in the streets rather than just sitting around having cocktails, I would suggest. But that's another day. Maybe it's not. Our country mourns the loss of a 17-year-old son, and we struggle as caring Americans to process the recent jury decision. I have two sons, and like all parents, I want to do all I can to protect them from injustice, ignorance, and pain. But this tragic death makes it clearer than ever before that our children are subject to the world we prepare for them. Each of us, families, neighbors, even strangers, have an obligation to contribute to a better, safer world for all of our children, not just those we raise. As a nation, we can do more, and we must. We must do more than simply protect them. We must fight to build communities that nurture them, that first look for their potential, not their threat. While our thoughts and prayers go out to the Martin family, they should be accompanied by a renewed commitment to protect all children, nurture intolerance, and fight for justice. So writes in this morning Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown from Orlando. 410-319-8888. Rhonda, you're on the air.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Rhonda.
It's Rhonda Winvis. Mark, well, I hope I don't say anything controversial. You know, I've been on your show, and sometimes people see me as controversy, having a little controversy there, but I expected the verdict. I didn't watch the hearing on TV because of that. And when we see in Baltimore City, I don't have to go to Florida. We see it right here. A month ago, a police officer strangled a young man, a teenager, on the ground, and he was found not guilty, and we didn't protest. We mumbled in the black community, oh, it was wrong. We don't have a state's attorney that will prosecute police officers that are killing black men right here in Baltimore City. So we don't have to go to Florida. This is the norm across our country. It is the norm in Baltimore City. But this is what I do know. Until black men stop killing each other, people will feel it's okay to kill them.
Well, let me wrestle with that, and let me read an email that just came in that also reflects on that. I'll let you all come in on this, okay? We have, I want to get Lenny back in before he has to leave, but Steve just wrote in something similar. Steve wrote in, reading so many passionate opinions about Martin Zimmerman case bothers me. The media decides certain deaths are important and we should care. Meanwhile, in my city alone, 126 people have been killed so far this year, many of them as young as Trayvon, and most of them black as Trayvon. In far too many cases, the perpetrators are walking around as free as George Zimmerman without having so much as questioned. Where's the outrage over those lost lives? If our protest for Trayvon, there should be a revolution for the mass slaughter that's going on in our cities.
Yeah, I would just say to the caller that I think she's referring to a trial that was prosecuted in Baltimore County, not Baltimore City, where a police
Christopher
officer,
Brown.
Right.
Yeah, where
right.
the police officer was acquitted. Again, if you take a look at the racial composition of that jury, you will not find hardly any African-American on that jury.
Chris Brown's jury.
Yes. So what happens, and again, police fall into a different category. I believe the officer in that case was indeed African-American.
Yes.
So what happens is that it's the police uniform that often gets protection when, in the rare instance, when a police officer is charged with a crime. And in those particular cases, it becomes even more difficult for the prosecutor to assure the public that they are capable of prosecuting the case to the fullest. I look at the system as requiring participation by all members of a community. And so whatever discussion takes place about the wrongness of a jury verdict, you must first look, A, at the jury racial composition, B, at the type of prosecution that was put forward, and C, the way in which a judge conducted the trial.
It makes me want to, what you just said about the jury for the officer who choked Christopher Brown to death on the front lawn. I was found not guilty of all charges. I'd be curious to know about the racial composition of juries in Baltimore County, because it's a majority white county. There's a multiracial county, but I was in a jury there once. It was an all white jury. Mm-hmm. They come out of Towson. All registered voters have to be, you know, there obviously. So I'd be very curious as to what the racial composition of juries are in Baltimore County.
People don't look at Baltimore County.
I don't know this.
I mean, the city is what gets the attention.
No, right, right.
It's the county that really needs for the light to shine within. And
right.
It's been a very difficult county for the media to cover. Everybody likes to look at the city, which actually does, in my opinion, a much better job than other parts of Maryland.
Lenny, before you have to roll a thought, I know you have to go in the next few minutes.
Well, I think that, one, I think everybody wants to talk about the black-on-black violence, and mm-hmm. I think that we've been talking about that. And we're also looking and understanding that, you know, a lot of this is jobs. A lot of this is education. A lot of this is the fact that when you have a bad economy and you have issues of institutionalized racism, such as the double unemployment rate that has been cemented in American society since they started keeping black unemployment in 1972, it is always roughly twice the rate as white Americans, regardless of what the economy looks like. Why is that the case? Why do black college graduates have twice the unemployment rate as their counterparts? They did a study 3 years ago where black Ivy League graduates had twice the unemployment rate than their classmates. Why is that the case? So we consider and talk about black-on-black crime and try to shift it away from what George Zimmerman did out of racial profiling over to black-on-black crime. But it's not as though we can't work in parallel. It's not like it's a serial problem where you work on black-on-black crime, then you work on this type of scenario. The bottom line is, before the black-on-black crime situation exploded like it has over the last 25 years, you still had Emmett Till. You still had Johnny Gamage. Excuse me. You still had situations where white perpetrators had a type of privilege when it came to dealing with black men, where black men and black people had to be subservient first and then figure it out. That is a problem that's been around in America since the Declaration of Independence.
So, I always appreciate you when you're on the show, and I thank you so much for doing this again today, and look forward to having you back on. Even when we had our right-left debates, conservative, liberal, whatever they are, you've always been a fascinating guest, and I thank you so much for always taking the time to be a member of the show.
Well, God bless you, Mark, and thank you for having me, and God bless you all, and God bless the United States of America.
We are going to take a brief break and come right back. What time is it? I mean, I'm losing track of time. It's almost 10 o'clock, so when we come back, we'll be joined by folks from Florida. We'll also be joined later on the program by Corey Dade, who's been covering this for the trial as well, for The Root. We'll also be talking to Aura Bogota from The Nation and a new news editor at Color Lines and her work in this trial. And we'll be reading a comment from Luis Rodriguez and more emails. And Catrice, you're the next caller up. Michael's next. And Tyrone coming in that order. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Keep on pushing. I've got to keep on pushing. Keep on pushing. I can't stop now.
Hello, liver cancer. Let me introduce you to my gang of bullies.
If you've been diagnosed with any gastrointestinal cancer, consider University of Maryland Greenbaum Cancer Center. A highly specialized team of experts will review your case and recommend promising solutions, many found only at National Cancer Institute designated centers like here.
Hey, tumor, take a hike.
University of Maryland Medical Center, medicine on a mission. Learn more at umm.edu.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Good to have you all with us. I want to remind you, support for WEAA is provided by Bosch, offering Bosch dishwashers at your local Bosch retailer. We are talking about the outcome of the George Zimmerman trial today, and we've been going through a number of guests. We have three guests in the studio remain with us the entire 2 hours. I deeply appreciate you taking time out of their busy day to do this. Doug Colbert, professor of law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law. Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, assistant professor of American Studies at UMBC and author of Blackberries and Redbones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body Politics, and Africana Communities. Adar Ayira, Project Manager of More in the Middle Initiative at Associated Black Charities, facilitator and analyst at Baltimore Racial Justice Action, and spoken word artist. I want to see her be a spoken word artist. I have not seen her do her stuff, and I want to see that. But Chiron the City, welcome to have you all with us. We are also joined here in this part of our program by Jack Lieberman, a longtime human rights activist from Miami, and Ayira, who's part of Dream Defenders. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
And Diara, are you there as well?
Hi, Diara's here.
Diara, welcome. Good to have you with us. And folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. On the way there, I'm going to read this piece that was, as I've been doing at the Huffy Chow from different people. This is written by a man whose name is Luis Rodriguez, who I would, just a disclaimer, is an old friend and a person I've worked with a lot on issues around the country. He's the author of the book Always Wrong, La Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A., and many other books, fiction and nonfiction. His work still in East L.A. and his work between both his Puerto Rican worlds and in Chicago and in Mexican worlds in L.A. He said, last night, my wife Trina and I watched the new film release Fruitvale Station soon after we heard about George Zimmerman's verdict. And if you haven't seen that movie, by the way, folks, it's amazing. We had the chance to interview the director and writer. It was a very one of the most amazing movies I've seen in a long time. Anyway, I digress. The film is based on how transit police officer killed 22-year-old Oscar Grant, who was unarmed at the Fruitvale train station in Oakland on his way from New Year's festivities. He was caught in circumstances of life, but for too many poor, black, and urban youth, these often end in death. Oscar Grant's killer was convicted of involuntary manslaughter and given 2 years. He was let go in 11 months. The people next to me were in tears. Not long ago, William Masters, a white jogger in L.A., was let go and freed, not even charged, having killed one Chicano youth and wounding another after he confronted them for supposedly tagging under a bridge. One of the youth was shot in the back. The police felt Masters was in danger and shot in self-defense. In my youth, sheriff's deputies killed four of my friends, unarmed and brown. When I moved back to L.A. from Chicago in 2000, after confronting years of Chicago police murders and even tortures of black and brown victims, a recent report of L.A. County Sheriff Department shootings, 51 in 1 year, proved they were all people of color, unarmed, and a few mentally ill. Here's the other side of the coin. I spoke at the largest juvenile lockup in North America last month for a graduation of 30 GED students. The place has between 800 and 1,000 prisoners, 90% or more are black or brown. The facility is 5 minutes from my house. Seven of the graduates talked at the podium, saying great words, talking about big dreams. More than a few are going to adult prisons for 25 years to life. Some of these cases didn't involve any actual involvement in murder, but often just being around with friends when someone was killed. The injustices in the face of the current justice system are palpable and patterned. Trayvon Martin deserved his day in court, his story told, his life given value. Any way you look at it, it was Zimmerman's actions that eventually led to Martin's death. In a culture where black youth are feared and profiled, still the patterns continue. We can't let up. Justice for Trayvon Martin must not end here. The circumstances of poverty, racism, and historical imbalances must now be put on trial. The anti-poor and anti-working-class criminal justice system must be on trial. The exploitative capitalist political and economic system must now be on trial. Most Americans were for fairness. The majority has no idea what the government has done. It's time to change the conversation. No more of our youth of any color should be profiled, sought, and then killed the way Trayvon was killed, the way Oscar was killed, the way those Chicano youth under the bridge were shot, or for my four homies. Nobody ever again. Luis Rodriguez. We'll be in his show shortly. Not today, but soon. 410-319-8888. Jack and Yara, welcome. It's good to have you with us. And I appreciate you coming here, joining us from Florida, where all this took place. Jack and I spoke over the weekend. Diara, we have not yet met, but I'm glad you joined us. You were Dream Defenders. Talk about, Diara, if you could, for a moment, the demonstrations that took place yesterday and what's about to take place in the Capitol.
Okay, so the Dream Defenders actually had several actions yesterday, one in Jacksonville, one in Tampa, and one in Miami. I was at the one in Jacksonville, and it was just incredible the amount of community members that came out. The action was planned around 3 o'clock in the morning, Sunday morning, and we had actual action at 5 p.m., and there were over 500 people there. And basically, we just gave everyone a platform to talk about how they feel about the case. And it was just very, it was refreshing to see or to hear people talking about, you know, a lot of the issues that are involved in the case that many people don't talk about. I mean, it's easy to, you know, talk about race in this case and stand your ground, but people were bringing it, you know, wider, talking about, you know, the juvenile justice system, talking about how we criminalize our black and brown youth in Florida and in this country as a whole. So that was action in Jacksonville. And tomorrow, Dream Defenders from all across the state will be joining in Tallahassee to take over the governor's office. And the action is basically, you know, to address the concerns of, you know, community members all across the state. The concerns I listed before, you know, we have Stand Your Ground, we have zero tolerance policy, which many people don't even think about in regards to this case. You know, if Trayvon Martin hadn't been suspended from school, he wouldn't even have been in Sanford, Florida that night last year. So there are a lot of issues involved in the case, and I'm just so proud of, you know, the people in Florida for, you know, looking beyond the obvious and really delving into the real issues here.
And Jack, let me ask you to comment a bit on the Stand Your Ground law, which I know is being confronted in Florida right now and its origins there. Because Florida led the country, not to be proud of, in Stand Your Ground.
Right. Well, it's a license to murder. I mean, we had a situation where one young man, African-American man, had his radio playing loud. A white man asked him to turn it down. He wouldn't turn it down. The white man said he was threatened, killed the guy in the parking lot, and got away with it on Stand Your Ground. I mean,
got away with it.
Instances after instances where things like this have happened. And it's outrageous. It's just a license for murder. This law has to be gotten off the books. What's a real disgrace is that it passed initially 39-0 in the Florida Senate. All the Democrats voted for it. We need to see the Democratic Party politicians take some action, and we need to see them come out. You know, the silence, in particular, of white politicians is particularly disgusting, okay? I mean, this needs to be, you know, if the Democratic Party wants black people and people of color and progressives, people like myself, to support them, you know, they have to step up to the plate here and support human rights. And, you know, they just can't take for granted that people are going to, you know, go out and campaign and support candidates. And then when a crisis like this happens, they're nowhere to be seen. And when they make a mistake and vote for a law like this, they need to be the first ones up front denouncing it and calling for change in it.
What else I think is interesting about this is we keep talking about aspects of Trayvon Martin in terms of being suspended from school, pot, et cetera, because we want to create this image of this black male who is a menace. And what I think is problematic in doing that is we create this idea that there is such a thing as a perfect victim, which doesn't exist, because all of us have something, some blemish that would make people raise their eyebrow and say, well, maybe there is something more to the story here. But yet again, we're forgetting that he was a 17-year-old kid. And what I think we have done, especially with our legal and judicial system, is now criminalize being a youth in our society. That by the time our young boy, black boys in particular, reach the age of 9 and 10, which becomes very personal to me as having a 9-year-old black son, once they become 9 and 10, we shift from seeing them as the cute little Johnnies that are in classrooms participating and helping out the teacher. Now they are the menace to society. And so we end up criminalizing them even further to suggest that we need to corral them in such a way that they need to be prosecuted for various offenses instead of being understood as children that need to be guided if they are misguided.
410-319-8888. Doug, you want to say something?
I just want to say that this conversation reminds me or brings up for me a report that was done in 1968 called the Kerner Commission Report.
Absolutely.
Where the former governor, former Illinois governor Otto Kerner, wrote a report with a whole slew of pretty impressive people. that we have two criminal justice systems in this country. One is for white crime victims and white defendants, and the other is for black and people of color who are crime victims and face trial on criminal charges. And there was an acknowledgement that racism had infected our system at every aspect of criminal
justice. This is 1968, we should be
talking. This is 68, right? Yeah. So we're talking 45 years ago. And we're talking about an acknowledgement, a recognition of this country's history. And that's when we talk about institutionalized racism. It's not as though it just disappears.
Right.
It's not the same as it was, of course. But every public official who's making important decisions, prosecutors who decide whom to charge, judges who decide who needs to stay in jail, who needs to go to prison, they have to look at race. They have to look at class. They have to understand that a justice system requires equal treatment. And you don't just give someone the break when they look like you or when you think that they come from a better background.
But what is also interesting is that Doug is raising is that many of the recommendations from that report still have not been actualized. And so we are still dealing with much of what was very apparent in 1968. But what also happens is we then enter in the 80s where Reagan presents to us this idea of being colorblind, this multicultural rhetoric that suggests we don't need to look at these issues. And so then we are bombarded with images of the Cosby Show and the likes of such programming that suggest to us we have actually moved away from so much of what was being dealt with in 1968's Kerner Report.
Let me get to the folks from Florida before they have to go and come back. And I think that we can spend another day actually talking about how deindustrialization of America, keeping people in poverty in black and brown neighborhoods since the 60s, which has just intensified, has added to the criminalization of and incarceration of too many black and brown people in America. But Diarra, I want you to just, before we have to go to our next guest, and we have a ton of people on the phone waiting to get this conversation we have to get to as well, talk about where you guys are going next and what you plan. What do you plan to organize around and what are you going to be doing?
Well, the Dream Defenders plan to continue to organize around the juvenile justice issues in Florida because we believe that's where a lot of the problems are coming from. In the criminalization of our youth, you know, it's tied to racism, but it's also tied to, you know, a lot of the racist legislation that affects young people. And this, you know, like I said before, it involves stand your ground. It involves zero tolerance policy that is taking young black and brown youth out of the classroom and into the jails. We're talking about, and when they do get to these detention centers, you know, they're given all these years, and then they get to the detention centers, and they're treated terribly, and a lot of times they're put in the same facilities as adults. So we're going to continue to fight for the youth in Florida and to expand as much as we can.
And Jack, some closing thoughts from you in terms of the work you're doing as an organizer and a human rights activist?
We're going to keep organizing on the ground here. We had a good demonstration yesterday. You know, we have a very serious situation, in particular in Miami. You know, it's 33 years since the McDuffie rebellion here, since Arthur McDuffie was killed by the police and touched off. The whole world knew about it. Major rebellion in the African-American community here. Recently, the Miami Police Department, they had a federal probe. They were found to be using excessive force, including causing the deaths of over half a dozen young African-American men. They're under investigation now. This has been an epidemic of violence against the black community here. So we have a bad situation in this community here, and I would say because of the leadership in the state government around the state. So what we really need to do is to hold our politicians' feet to the fire. Like I said, in particular, I think the Democrats here need to come out squarely against the Stand Your Ground law, and it needs to be repealed. And that needs to be a major issue in the upcoming elections here.
And I think that Stand Your Ground law is something that I think that is something that America really needs to wrap their hands around, especially we're broadcasting from Baltimore, Maryland. So Maryland doesn't know much about Stand Your Ground. We don't have it here in the state. And we have enough problems without it. But but the Stand Your Ground law is part of a right-wing, and I would say funded by many wealthy corporations, right-wing push with their racist allies to kind of arm white people in America to defend themselves against what they called chaos and tyranny and anarchy, as well as the threat from Arabs overseas. And it's part to me. This is part of what we were talking about earlier, Dar, which is part and parcel of the kind of retrenchment. The same way that Reconstruction was killed with the legalization of segregation. We're not going to legalize segregation in America, not in that way. But we are. It's a retrenchment. There is a battle going on for the future of America in front of our eyes.
Absolutely. And as the racial demographics of this country continue to change, we will see more and more of that battle. And I think that Mark, that is why we really need to become more savvy in our conversations and more proactive in working with our allies as well as those across the aisle to change lenses. Until we get off the track of the color blindness, which we also call colorblind racism or multicultural racism, that talking about race is in itself racist. That if we're not racist as a country, we wouldn't even be raising these issues. We need to talk about institutional and structural racism because policy is where transformation happens. And what we do as activists, what we do in the streets, has to be translated into the suites, and that has to be translated into policy for transformation to take place. And the only way that we do that is, number one, by holding politicians accountable. We have to be more savvy and engaged in policy. Number two, we need to be working to expand the lens of people. When we start talking about race, individual white people think, oh, you're talking about me. Not understanding that the conversation we're having is not interpersonal. It is structural and institutional. And if we as a society want to cling to our notions of fairness and that everybody has a chance and an opportunity, though that notion cannot exist with the notion of institutional and structural racism. And that's one of the reasons why we discount it, because we prefer to hold on to the notion of fairness than working to achieve the actual reality of fairness. We must have these conversations.
So first, let me thank Jack Lieberman and Dara for being with us. It's been a pleasure to have you both on. I see Jack is gone. But Jack, I'll tell him later. It's always good to have him on the show. He does a great deal of work. And Ira, if you want to just hang out for a while, you can. But I appreciate you being part of the show today. And I really appreciate all the stuff that all you folks in Florida are doing to stand up for justice.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. Let me go right to the phone to get some of our listeners in. 410-319-8888. Catrice, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sorry you had to wait so long.
When I hear that Trayvon Martin caused his own death, it breaks my heart, because he's just a teenager that was minding his business, wasn't looking to do anything to anybody. Zimmerman was the one that pursued Trayvon Martin. And I'm so tired of hearing people compare this to crimes that happen, drug-related crimes, or gang violence. It's not the same. The devastation with this is that this happened in a neighborhood, in a place where you would think you would be safe to walk to the store and back home. You don't think that you have to be dodging bullets or anything like that. It reminds me of when my brother, he attended Glen Burnie High School in Glen Burnie, Maryland, and he got sick one day, and his female white classmate said, "Why don't you go to my house and take a nap until it's time to go home?" So my brother took her key, went to her house, took a nap, and did just that. Went back to the school, because she lived directly across the street from the school. And because he tried to reach my parents, he couldn't reach them. And so anyway, when my parents found out that he did this, my mother literally was in tears. She said, "You could have been killed." And he said, "Why?" Because they didn't raise us to be raised. They didn't raise us to not like white people or anything. And she said, "Because you're a young black boy going to somebody's house. The neighbors could have thought you were trying to break in. The parents could have been home and thought you were trying to rob them. They could have gotten home work from early." And my brother said, "But I had permission and I had the key." And my mother said, "That doesn't matter. You're a young black boy." And my mother was literally in tears, and she was crying because my brother didn't get the message. And he accused my parents of being racist. And they were saying, we're not racist, but you're a young black man, and you have to see that that's the first thing that the world is going to see from you. Then began the training for my father. My father got really strict with my brother, getting him to understand some things of how he has to talk, walk, and behave. And it concerns me now because I was 17 years ago, and so now how can we say we're equal to white people or any other culture isn't superior to another culture, but yet black boys have to be trained how to behave and how to respond. And that's one of the things that bothered me the most, that George Zimmerman didn't identify himself as any kind of neighborhood watch, because I believe Trayvon Martin's response would have been very different, not feeling like this is a stranger. I don't know what he's trying to do. Let me defend myself. You know, he would have probably responded, oh, I'm here at this location, because black boys are trained that way. That when an officer pulls you over, don't reach for your wallet. Let them know you're going to get your registration. I mean, I can just remember the things that, my brother was trained about. And, like, how do you teach, like you said, how do you teach a young black man that you're equal, but yet you have to learn how to be somewhat.
Catricia, your story is, I mean, really kind of powerful, truthful, and the reality of where we are and remain where we are today. And I'm glad you held on to tell the story. And Corey Dade is contributing to The Root, where he's been covering this amendment trial. Corey, I'm sorry it took so long to get you on the phone here. I know you have many interviews ahead of you. You heard Catrice's story. Your thoughts on that and what you've been watching in the aftermath of the trial.
Hi, Mark. Yeah, I can identify as a journalist, I can identify with what she said, but as a black man, I can identify with it also. A year ago, a little bit more than a year ago, when this shooting occurred, I actually wrote a very personal sort of first-person account of Paul the Talk. It's a rite of passage that black boys get in the way of a lesson from their parents. You know, there's the conversation about the birds and the bees, and for young black men, it's a conversation. It's those conversations plus, as a black young black man, you need to know this. And really, what I wrote about is a series of basically bullet points of rules that I was given about how to govern myself in public. And it was all calibrated to basically account for other people's biases. Now, we all do that in many ways, but as a young black man, you know, we have to thread a needle. And as parents, we have to thread a needle by being mindful of other people's hang-ups, being mindful of other people's biases, but not letting it rule us to the point where we get irrational. It is one of those facts of life for young black men where we have to live our lives accounting for other people's hang-ups on a daily basis.
And so, where is your work going to take you right now since the trial is over? I'm curious what you're going to be focusing on.
Well, we're looking at what's next. Of course, the Department of Justice has announced that it will review this case to see if there is cause for them to bring a civil rights case against George Zimmerman. And in this case, it would be based on whether or not George Zimmerman racially profiled Trayvon Martin. Of course, over the weekend, you had a lot of people calling for that investigation, including many members of Congress, Black Caucus members. It's sort of a watch now to see what happens. The key to keep in mind, though, is that this is this particular legal effort requires a pretty high burden of proof on the part of the Justice Department. These racial profiling and, in general, these kinds of civil rights violations are not frequently brought because it's very difficult to prove. We're sort of watching that as it happens.
Yeah, that's what we have to, and I'm very curious to see who in Congress supports this act beyond the Black Caucus.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That will tell us a lot.
Say a great deal, especially some of the more progressive and liberal members of Congress who are not African-American. I'd like to see how they stand up to this.
It's true that Department of Justice has not frequently invoked its power to prosecute after states have failed to do justice. And it is also true that proving willful intent requires a burden. But most of the time, in my opinion, that explains why federal prosecutors are reluctant to intervene has to do with giving undue respect to the state's right to prosecute local offenders. And when we talk about states' rights, we're going back in time now to saying that the federal government really doesn't have a role in state criminal justice systems. So if the federal government is serious about getting involved here, one word of advice would be make sure that a federal jury is comprised of a significant number of African-American right. people. Make sure that you are going to question and challenge George Zimmerman and see him as the aggressor. Because objectively, it's very difficult not to see somebody who's chasing, pursuing someone and armed with a gun as the person we would normally associate as the aggressor.
Corey Day, thank you so much, brother, for being with us. And we will take a brief break and have you back very soon as we see how this unfolds. Don't go away. We have other guests coming up. And, of course, we're going to go to the phones. There's Michael and Tyrone and Donna and Brenda. We're going to get your call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, brother, brother.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have you back with us. We're here with Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Assistant Professor of American Studies at UMBC, author of Blackberries and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body Politics, and Africana Communities, Adar Ayira, Project Manager of the More in the Middle Initiative at Associated Black Charities, Facilitator and Analyst at Baltimore Racial Justice Action, Spoken Word Artist as well, Doug Colbert, Professor of Law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law. Number here is 410-319-8888. Remind you that tonight at 5 p.m. to let you know that there will be a demonstration in downtown Baltimore for justice in the Trayvon, in the Zimmerman case. It'll be taking place at the McKeldin Plaza, downtown Baltimore, today at 5 o'clock. And our number here is 410-319-8888. I want to go right to the phones. We have a lot of people coming in. We want to get to this conversation. But, Doug, we talked to him break about something you said you think is critical to bring up about what was not brought up in this case when it came to Trayvon Martin and the murder of Trayvon Martin.
Well, I think one of the ways in which the jury's racial composition matters is how they view evidence. And one of the glaring pieces of evidence that the prosecution actually did a good job on was when Mr. Guy brought out a dummy and the expert witness had just testified that to a reasonable degree of certainty he was convinced that Trayvon Martin was on top of Mr. Zimmerman. Okay, so the dummy positioned the prosecutor to say to the expert, okay, where would Trayvon have been sitting? And he put him pretty much in the middle of his chest, you know, and he's on top of him, presumably. Now, Zimmerman's gun is on the inside thigh. It's inside his right pocket. And every time that the prosecutor said, is this where you would say Trayvon Martin is? And he positioned him. And then he said, so this gun is way down below, and there's no way that somebody could reach that weapon. Zimmerman's story made it, to the police at least, was that he felt Trayvon Martin's hand going towards the gun while he's underneath him. He felt it, and somehow with his other hand, he was able to grab Martin's hand before it got to the gun, get the gun himself, and then he shot him presumably in the chest. Now, the story is so preposterous when you actually try to put it together. But if you're of a mind bent, as I believe this jury was, and not because they were all racist, but because there's like a collective mentality that saw Zimmerman as a protector of the homeowners community, of the community where I will presume that most of the jurors could identify with. He was seen as a protector, not the predator that others would have seen Zimmerman as he was trying to track down Mr. Martin. So the idea here is how can a jury not reject Mr. Zimmerman's account of how he got the weapon? And once you do that, the whole story falls apart. Then you have the shooting taking place when it was much more of a face-to-face situation, not when Martin was presumably on top, but when they were in a whole different paradigm.
But say that they believed every aspect of that. The bottom line is what this jury has said is that they can Zimmerman could stand his ground while he was stalking and attacking a young 17-year-old armed with Skittles and iced tea, but that 17-year-old could not stand his ground in terms of dealing with a man who was stalking and who attacked him. So the stand your ground works one way for white men or white people or people seen as protectors only, regardless of how they are abusing that.
Adar, the only thing I would say is that that stand your ground defense was not used in this case.
No, I know it wasn't,
but still, I understand what your point is.
Yeah.
Let me go to the phone. So 410-319-8888. Michael, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hey, Mark and Adar. Mike Schaff from Equity Matters. I think you know, you've had a rich conversation this morning, and some of the key words that jumped out at me, and I'll just make two quick points around both privilege. And you know, you can't talk about privilege without gatekeeping, and this whole colorblind, you know, race card. I think we need to start talking about odds, right? So someone mentioned the generation folks, you know, and I think that's not helpful because, you know, we could get into a debate around, you know, how the baby boomers are among, you know, literally speaking, the most privileged generation in the history of America. And we all stand on shoulders, so that's number one. And we can't have this generation. What we all have to do is examining our gatekeeping, our privilege. We all have privilege, even the least among us. And if we're examining that, then we have a mechanism by which to hold all of us accountable and to be productive. So I think that's one thing. It's not helpful for this generational divide, or with, even within the black community, those of us who have privilege. Or even who get to frame the conversation or the argument. We need to think about that. But the second thing is this notion of the race card. You know, it's so disingenuous every time I hear it. And I always say it's not about playing a card. It's about the house rules. And the house rules, the odds are skewed towards some folks more than others. And until we start understanding how these odds congregate, we can't disrupt them. And so those are my two comments as well. It's been a rich discussion. And boy, we all have a lot of work to do, huh?
Michael, thanks so much. Always good to have you join us here on the air. Let's get another call in here. Let me introduce our next guest who just arrived. I just saw that. We are now joined by Aura Bogota, and it's always a pleasure to have her back with us here on the program. Aura Bogota is a blogger at Nation Magazine and writes for Nation Magazine, and also is news editor at Color Lines. And Aura, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
And how are you?
I'm doing well this morning. How are you?
Good. Well, good to have you with us. And we're here in the studio with our other three guests, Adar Ayira, Kimberly Moffitt, and Doug Colbert, and you all at 410-319-8888. And on the way back to the phones here, I was reading some of the stuff you posted on The Nation and covering this trial. And just share with us a bit about your analysis of what this moment says to us.
Well, I think that it might be a good time to sort of take pause and look at some of the underlining ideology that sort of helped this verdict come to light. There's been some confusion as to whether or not George Zimmerman is Latino, and you could sort of, by observing him, you know, at the defense table, his mother who was on the stand, his sister that was often sitting sort of behind him during the trial. They certainly are Latino, and I think that the Latino community has had a hard time sort of claiming him because they are often also racially profiled. And I think that's part of what's missing in that is really looking at the underlying ideology of white supremacy. And just to be clear, when I say white supremacy, I don't mean white supremacists like the KKK, but I mean an ideology that sustains that some people's lives are worth more than others. And it's really on a gradient scale according to skin color. And so when you have the defense using coded language like Trayvon Martin came out of the darkness, when you have them saying that Trayvon Martin was armed with the sidewalk, and those of us who have seen those really graphic images of Trayvon Martin's body, you know, where it was found, there isn't sidewalk below him, there's grass. And so someone, you know, might want to sort of wonder, well, how is it that he's armed with concrete when it isn't even underneath him? And I think that it goes back to this anxiety around black bodies and the black body as a weapon, and therefore the ground that it walks on is also an extension of that weapon. And so I think that it makes a lot more sense to sort of look at the underlying ideology, and not that a lot of people would necessarily support Zimmerman if he was, for example, looked the way he did and was crossing through the border. But when he employs the sort of ideology that says, well, a kid that looks like Trayvon Martin, that is a black teenager walking through my neighborhood, makes me feel unsafe, he's employing an ideology which in some ways at the root of it could go after somebody who looks like him, but in the end he uses to sort of defend his own actions.
Folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Let me go to the phones here and try to get as many calls as we can in for the end of the hour. And Tyrone, you're on the air.
Mark, the judge, the state's attorney, his lawyer, and the jury was all in cahoots together in this situation, and they got the kind of outcome and the kind of results that they wanted. You can't even really blame George Zimmerman on this situation. You mean, he killed Trayvon without a doubt in our mind, with people with eyes to see and ears to hear, know that that was murder. But at the same time, George Zimmerman himself is a victim of the same racist prejudice, bias, unfair and unjust judicial system that we all live by. Now, The question was asked, trying to make sense in all this insanity that we're dealing with in the world today. I mean, how do you look at the exact, make sense of all the insanity that's going on today without looking at first, how did we get here? And what brought us to this point? The whole country itself was founded on genocide and slavery. Genocide because there were already black people living here when Europeans came to America, I mean, which were the West Indians, you know what I mean? And Europeans did everything they could to exterminate and kill those people. And now here comes after that the slave trade. And how did we come into America? That Eddie Murphy movie was really just a joke. Because for black people, coming to America ain't nothing but a horror and a nightmare since we've been here. And we have been through nothing but, we have been terrorized and tortured and shown nothing but hate and violence from generation to generation. It's crazy, but this is what we've been through and where we at now. We're still dealing with racism and prejudice and discrimination against black people right here even today. And another question is, in a fair and just judicial system, how do you have an all-white jury?
Tyrone, I appreciate you being part of the show, and I'm glad you raised some of the issues you raised. And I think that the disconnect in America between people think is fairly profound. Let me turn back to our guest here in this part of our program to respond. I'll read this from Facebook. These are things that came through our Facebook page to show the disconnect in America. And I've been writing back and forth all weekend, which is why I was so depressed the whole weekend long after preparing for this show. A young woman writes in, her name is Lyndon. How do you know that, talking about that he was profiled and that I said that Zimmerman had profiled Trayvon Martin? Really? The hoodie hides everything, especially in the dark. Zimmerman was not identified as Hispanic by the media because the media wants to fuel the fire and ratings. Just look at him. It's obvious. So what? Sebastian says the physical evidence just didn't support the view. Black folk get short shrift in our society, there no doubt, but in this case, it's just not that simple. There are many horrific crimes committed against white and blacks. The point is the media has made this division between us instead of treating it as it was. If you want to be confronted by the media and spread hate and disconnect, I can't stop this. Only the media can. And let me finish with this, that if you're trying to build a colorblind society, hair-splitting about Zimmerman, his identity, is obviously not the way to do it. It's not either or. Black folk can be – was the last part I want to read here? I'm sorry. I'll get to this other piece in a minute. But anyway, what I'm trying to find here, the pieces in here that people have written Aura, that is a real disconnect in America over perceptions of this trial. People talking about colorblindness, talking about it's not really about race, that the evidence didn't stand up, and that we're trying to make it about race, you're just dividing America even more. And there is this huge divide in our country that this trial, I think, has brought to the fore.
I think that this trial is fundamentally about race, and I think that people of color and white allies, it has been very clear for those communities for quite a long time since we all heard about it, frankly. And I think that this idea that it's somehow not about race, the same media that sort of for the last couple of weeks, at least during the trial, largely masked the idea of race, echoing what was happening in the courtroom, right? The attorneys on both sides didn't bring up the racial issue really clearly right until the very end. And, you know, going back to what I was talking about earlier, using sort of coded language, like Trayvon Martin coming out of the bushes, et cetera. And you also had a lot of PSAs running, telling black folks in particular, black communities in Florida, to, you know, stay calm. And then you heard mass media nationally saying, speculating about a fear that there were going to be Rodney King-style riots, right? As if Rodney King, if we remember 20 years ago, as if he was actually the one on trial. So I think that in and of itself is sort of telling. But what we didn't hear are the kinds of PSAs that keep people from attacking people of color. We know that Lester Chambers, for example, was attacked when he was about to perform at a concert. He dedicated the song that he was about to sing to Trayvon Martin, and a woman attacked him, sort of brutally attacked him. My understanding is that he did have to go to the hospital, and I did see photos in which his body is quite bruised. And so there was no PSA that sort of told white folks, hey, no matter what happens, please don't go out and attack a performer for exercising his free speech and doing something as sort of normal as dedicating a song to a child who lost his life. And, for that person who committed that killing to sort of be found not guilty on all charges, right? And so this is about race. As much as it was sort of masked again by the mass media during the trial that kept saying, this is an all-woman jury, this is a jury that's mostly composed of mothers, it was actually a majority white jury, right? Five out of the six, we know, five of the six jurors were white, and we know that statistically, I mean, it's a fact, right, whether we like it or not, mostly white juries tend to acquit when the victim is black. And so in that way, it shouldn't have been surprising what the outcome was going to be, but media didn't want to sort of, couldn't see it in that way, could only see the gender and couldn't approach race unless they started speculating about how people might respond. And, you know, I was out last night from Union Square to Times Square all the way to Park Avenue, right? And there were seven arrests. It mostly came out of the police, and I say this as a person who was there and witnessed this, as people got closer to one of the Koch brothers' apartments on Park Avenue, the police came out in a column and literally, I'm not exaggerating, literally started punching people in the face, particularly women, so that they couldn't get anywhere closer to the apartment, right? And so that's the kind of violence that I think, you know, could have been helpful, right? PSAs for the police for how they should respond to people being angry and exercising their First Amendment right to, you know, go out onto the streets and claim that anger. And it's unfortunate because some of the conversation is being lost there in terms of who gets addressed and how.
Mark, I will say that, and trying to put the last few comments together, clearly there is a racial divide and there will be a pronounced division between the two communities about whether they agree or disagree with this verdict. You know, when George talks about how do we get to an all-white jury, you know, as an educator, and we're all educators, we need to inform people about this country's history, this history of exclusion, of disqualification, of elimination from participating fully. So juries, the prototype American jury in our country has been all white with occasional token representation. That's who our justice system represents, particularly when it's an interracial crime. And so if we have any hope at all here, we have to come to grips with history. When Angela Corey, the special state prosecutor, she was so confused. You know, at the press conference afterwards, she said, this case is not about race. But, you know, right. Trayvon Martin was definitely profiled. It's like you right. can't have that both ways. It's almost like I can't put the two things together, but I know something was wrong about what Zimmerman did, but I'm not going to say it was racial profile, but it was profiling.
Kimberly?
No, I was just many of the comments that have been made over the last few minutes take us right back to, again, that black body being the space that occupies or holds the pathology of violence. And so we wouldn't see PSAs instructing any other group to not act out or to lash out because that pathology only resides in black bodies and especially black male bodies. So it's blacks that need to be told to keep calm or remain calm, especially in light of 20 years ago with the situation with the beating from in LA, in the LA riots. I also think we're in a space, I know you've talked about kind of this is a backlash to Reconstruction and where we are, but I think we can even look at more contemporary examples of the 80s again in terms of so much of the multicultural rhetoric that was being used during my time going through K through 12 schooling where we were giving messages to say this was no longer an issue, that we needed to move on. And we had so many icons to reinforce that for us through media, whether it was artists and performers or whether it was on television. There was so much that gave us this kind of kumbaya moment in the 80s. And part of it is we were blinded by whether or not it existed because we seemed to believe in the fact that we were all riding on high in terms of the economic system that was in place for us during the 80s. And so now what I see unfolding is this backlash to that whole idea of multiculturalism. Like, no, we played that game. It doesn't work. Now this is what is back in our face again instead of believing that we are in this space of kumbaya.
Until this country is willing to come to grips about its history, about the legacy, and about the continuation of the impact of institutional and structural racism, which your guest on the phone, and I love your blog, by the way, she gave such a clear Thank definition you. Of, unless that happens, then we are going to continue to move in the direction in which we have always moved. We need to face that and to understand that it is not about white guilt, it is not about blame, it is about this country living up to what and whom it says it is.
And we're just about out of time here, and I'm going to say I think we'll continue looking at this conversation, and I think this is also about a political struggle to redefine what America is and what it should be. And I'm reminded always of Langston Hughes' poem that I'll read the beginning and end of real fast here for all of us. Called Let America Be America Again, when he wrote, "Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be the pioneer of the plain, seeking a home where he himself is free. America never was America to me. Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed. Let the great strong land of love where the kings convive, nor tyrants scheme, that any man may be crushed by one above. It never was America to me." And he closed with, "Oh, yes, I say it plain. America never was America to me, and I swear this oath, America will be. Out of the rack and ruin of our gangster death, the rape and rot of craft, stealth and lies, we the people must redeem the land, the mines, the plants, the rivers, the mountains, and the endless plain. All that stretch of these great green states and make America again." It does take all of us in the political struggle to redefine this country and make it what it can be and needs to be if we are to survive as human beings on this planet Earth. We will be talking more this week to others, I will be on break with other people coming in to do some co-hosting, including Keith Snipes and Dr. Kimberly Moffitt. will be joining us here on this program. I want to thank one of my favorite bloggers, I think one of the rising young thinkers in our community, Arba Goda. Thanks for closing out our show with us. We'll be attaching to all your stuff here on our website, standardshow.org. Adar, Ayira, Kimberly Moffitt, Doug Holbrook, great to have three of you. Thank you so much for being in the studio for these last couple of hours.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark. It's good to have you all with us. I also want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, go to www.mecu.com. We are going to go out here as we read the rest of these credits, and we'll play in as much of the song as there. We're going to play Nina Simone singing Strange Fruit, something for us to reflect on as we walk out the door together and get that started. Remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis, Mark Gunnery, and Bobby Marvin Holmes. Our engineers, Andrea Melton. Our interns are Lila Warshaw, Albert Phillips Jr., Danielle Dupree, Alexander Rudy, Sinead Hawkins, and Kamani Seldon. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. You can hear this show and podcast our shows and find information about our guest at steinershow.org. And remember, you can listen and download all of our podcasts on iTunes. And for Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, let's remember justice for all in America. Keep fighting for a better country that we need to have to survive. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.
Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant South. Them big balls.